good afternoon, good morning, or whenever you happen to be listening to this. Welcome to the Film Roast Podcast, film and TV podcast from a complete nobody that is hopefully for somebody.
My name is Kyle Naranya, and as you have already heard, I am joined by Film Realist Junior Critic Sawyer, and on this week's episode, we are going to be reviewing Minions and Monsters, the third Minions film in the seven-long franchise that is the Despicable Me franchise. Because this is a feature film review, there will be a brief non-spoiler section, and then Sawyer will join me for the spoilers for Minions and Monsters. Time codes will be listed in the description should you feel the need to hop around. Now let's dive into a classic Hollywood tale of Minions and Monsters.
Oh, you see those large, heavily armed men? They suspect you have killed their leader.
And they want you dead.
Quick. Quick?
Something that is very funny to me about this franchise is that I have not actually had a chance to review any of them on the podcast yet. The only one that has come out since the launch of Film Realist, ironically, is Despicable Me 4. But obviously not talking about that today. It's going to be the review of Minions and Monsters. And I have not been shy about the junk foodification of films aimed at children. A lot of people will just call them kids' films, and I think that's derogatory to that particular form of art. Looking at Toy Story 5, which was reviewed relatively recently, Despicable Me is a great film for kids. The sequels, I don't think, have managed to sort of deliver as heartwarming or emotional a story since the launch 16 years ago, which is maddening. And the Minions movies, for the most part, have just leaned into the absurdity and decided to not really focus on what makes this world interesting or tell a story that's worth telling. They've been, for the most part, pretty forgettable. And that's where I sit going into Minions and Monsters, and I do my absolute best to not have any preconceived notions going into a film. But what's hilarious in the non-spoilers is I can say Minions and Monsters is easily the best Minions movie. And you know what? Maybe by the end of this, I'll be able to say where I think it belongs in all seven of this films in this franchise. We decide to actually have Minions be the focus, which of course the Minion films have done. But the story is much more interesting in what it wants to evaluate and explore. As we've seen in all the marketing material, the idea of the Minions working throughout the ages of Hollywood is fun and entertaining. As a diehard film fan, of course, I thoroughly appreciate anything that shows, especially kids now who may be 6 years old and this is one of the first movies they're seeing, or even younger, what Hollywood has been. What are the different eras of Hollywood? Even talking about how things have gone from black and white, silent pictures, just Hollywood in general has changed so dramatically, even in my own lifetime alone, to have two characters who really want to drive up the creativity as opposed to just having the absurdity be wacky villains or big bads, which has been the sole purpose of the Minions characters. This movie actually bothers to have main characters that are interested in something and are just interesting themselves. There is so much film history and Easter eggs plugged into this that strategically are obviously aimed at the adults, and that part is fine. Talking about Shrek 2 on the Movies to Watch Before You Die podcast a couple weeks ago, looking at how you can integrate so many things for the adults, but what manages to make a well-executed family-friendly film work is when that story is applicable and can be touched on from the different age groups that are going to be watching the movie. What's most interesting, and this is one of the most frustrating parts of where we are now within the film-going audience, is this is the best Minions film, and it has performed under expectations, which just goes to show, I think particularly when it comes to the competition that is going to be out there. Toy Story 5, which was always going to be a monster hit, has continued to have legs in end of June into July, where just barely Minions and Monsters has one out on the weekend, but in earlier eras, both films would have been absolutely huge. And the fact that over the 5-day run, this is only at $61 million is shocking. This is a franchise that was making billions without even trying. And what's frustrating about that now is you see a franchise that is really interested in actually telling a story, and the film is not perfect. I'll get into the things that didn't necessarily work for me a little bit later. But I commend everybody involved for wanting to explore creativity through the means of the Minions franchise / Despicable Me. Of course, the Minions films or the Minions characters within the Despicable movies are the side characters. They're off on their own tangential missions. And what's funny about Minions and Monsters, it still delivers on the expectations of what you get from these characters. The Minions are best when they are sort of filling in that gap of filmmaking that we don't really have anymore, much more in the Looney Tunes aspect of slapstick. Those moments are hilarious. Sawyer's going to come and tell you exactly what worked for him about the film. But the way that they weave in the narrative on exploring where these characters are, and what's funny is even though this is the third Minions movie, it is not Minions 3. That's the most interesting part of where we are in the Despicable Me franchise. Minions 2, The Rise of Gru, brought our Minions to Gru, which you would think, where are we going now? No, that sort of branch of the Minions leads directly into Despicable Me 1, and we don't get a young adult, really truly evil Gru, because the audience has now expected that he is that loving and caring father on the side of good. This group of Minions is much more interested in finding the big bad, but when you have conflict within the Minions about their purpose in life, you get to explore a message that, while not inherently new and original, delivers it effectively enough. What's interesting is the biggest hurdle and problem for this film is we have so much looking at the golden era of Hollywood and the change into the talking picture. The monsters portion might be the most shoehorned in part of the story. When we are actually looking at what the characters want to be doing in terms of being successful in Hollywood with James and Henry, the monsters in the overall plot really are just there to serve a purpose in the overall narrative of the story, as opposed to feeling like they are eloquently woven in to the main plot. They are just a tool to move the characters forward. And I think that's what's most frustrating is the marketing early on in this film was very much so on the monsters and the summoning of Cthulhu and what was that going to be about, where they're just sort of added into the movie because they need some further conflict down the line. What's funny is there's a side story that is much more built and connected into the history of Hollywood that I don't want to spoil here, that I thought worked much more effectively in also helping explore the era in which this movie is taking place. We are not in the present, and because they allow themselves to do that, you get to explore so many different places to where America was socio and economically in all of those aspects at that time. I can just picture what everyone is thinking listening to this. Yes, Minions and Monsters is entertaining. As a diehard film fan, it's great to see movies about making movies. This is a subgenre within the fiction realm of cinema that doesn't nearly get to be done as much just because it's not something that seems to be as interesting. It is very confusing that a movie like this is not the smash hit you would expect it to be. I wanted to, and I never wound up doing it, coming up with what was going to make the most money in July. Maybe else I'll do that by the end of it, but I feel like it would be cheating at this point. I myself am surprised that I thoroughly enjoyed Minions and Monsters. It was much more entertaining than I was suspecting it was going to be. It's far less junk food than the two previous Minions films. And just in terms of illumination, this is still probably one of their better films. This studio can do great things, but more often than not chooses to not. Look at Super Mario Galaxy, the movie, which came out just a couple months ago. So credit to everybody involved for wanting to deliver a fun, entertaining film that still has a little to say. It's not going to be Pixar, but it doesn't need to be. Illumination had a win with this, and I'm really excited to bring Sawyer on for spoilers, because who better to describe what they liked about this film than a six-year-old? Sawyer, let's get into spoilers.
Oh, James. Rolls off the face tendrils. James.
Is that it, Henry?
Hey, Bello.
Henry. Oh, I like it. It sounds tough and rugged. It's like, oh, look out, here comes Henry.
The beginning of the movie's really compelling because of the way that it integrates the Minions in what they know of Hollywood. We see prior to them getting to Hollywood that they worked for a warlock, and we see the spell book that summons the bunny that was in the trailer. And that scene is only in the movie so that they can summon the monsters later. And that to me is the most frustrating part. You market a movie called Minions and Monsters, and the monsters feel like a complete afterthought that are integrated only once James and Harry have to, it's Henry. And when they have to make their own movie, they're not woven into the whole story. They are just in the very beginning because it feels like they were coming up with the script and retroactively, how do we bring in the fact that they're going to summon monsters with a spell book? So that to me is one of the most annoying aspects. If this was just like the Minions make a movie, something other than just what is quite literally the last third of the film, as opposed to even half. That to me was very frustrating. Sawyer, what did you think about how they brought the monsters into the movie?
Okay, so when the Minions brought the monsters into the movie, it's like, yes, I'm free, pretending to be good. And then when they're making the movie, he's evil. And then Henry, they're acting like Henry's playing the first part where he dies. And then Henry's playing the first part. And then Henry's trying to say, like, no, but they have his mouth tied up. So James can't understand Henry. And they're trying to be evil.
So yeah, what you're referring to there, Sawyer, is a good point, which is they summoned the monsters, Gumi, who we would have heard in the intro bit leading into this, who Gumi then leads them to summon two other monsters, which are, what are their names? I've forgotten. Philip and Howard, and they pretend to be good so that way they can summon another monster. They're going to be a part of James and Henry's film, and as opposed to having some sort of major or overarching threat, it's just, we're going to use, who was it? Was it James or was it Henry? Who gets tied up? Henry gets tied up only so they can sacrifice him for Irene, who's a big blob monster full of eyes. I really loved, as I said this in non-spoilers, I loved all the Hollywood stuff. What did you think, Sawyer, about watching all the Minions making different movies?
Okay, so when they were making movies, it's kind of rude. Because Henry's trying to get them a monster. No, Gumi or whoever's trying to get them a monster. He knows where they are. And he uses the machine to break free Gumi. No, wait. Whoever and whoever.
Philip and Howard.
And then they kind of just try to make the movie better. But also they're kind of making it evil. But at the end of the movie, it's pretty happy because Ed never stopped filming.
So what you're referencing there, I'm glad you brought that up because I wasn't able to do that in non-spoilers. We see in the beginning of the film a group of museum goers somewhere, likely in Hollywood, and they're seeing the history of film, and James and Henry are referenced in this museum. We also see George Lucas. I really hope they donated to his charity or something. And the Olivia, the tour guide, played by Allison Janney, is shocked that the children at the museum don't know who James and Henry are. She then goes on to tell the story. So that's the framework for how we go back in time. What is revealed is that the entire movie is James and Henry making their movie. So this movie was being made in the present. And none of the things we saw were ever real. I do like the twist in that, where it's very in line with something like the Lego Movie, which was Emmett and Wildstall and all those characters were being played inside Lord Business's son's head. It's a very fun twist, but I don't think the movie does enough to establish that that is what is actually happening. The earlier movie stuff is excellent, getting to see how talkies were integrated, and it's very funny, of course, because the Minions don't speak English, they speak Minionese. And the other main part of the story, and I've referenced this already in non-spoilers, is there is an alien robot called Dort, who is a reference to Gort from The Day the Earth Stood Still. And what I like so much about his story is, similar to the Minions, he is learning about how humanity works in this time frame. Women are fighting for the right to vote, and he's sort of learning about humanity by going on dates, which is very, very funny. Sawyer, what did you think of that?
Okay, so when Dort was walking with the Minions, he was like, "Dort, Dort." And then this rude lady says, "Keep the noise down." And then he is like, "Oh, I shall kick this kid." And like, the lady is like, "No, you can't kick kids."
You need to explain that, because I think it's important for that, which is, he plants his flag in the child's sandcastle, and then the child is mad that Dort did that. And because Dort is an alien robot, he doesn't know how to have any conflict resolution.
And then Dort is like, "This lady, you can't kick him." And then what the lady...
Her name is Debbie.
Debbie is like, "You can't kick this kid." And then Dort is like, "Oh, so what you're saying is now I'm free to kick the kid."
That introduction of Dort being upset with the child and not knowing you shouldn't be kicking children is what leads him to talk to Debbie, who is a strong-willed suffragette fighting for women's rights. That's what was happening in this time frame. And Dort learns about humanity because of his relationship with Debbie. And what's funny about this character is we get to see the Minions follow somebody, because they've always looked for the big bad. They're always looking for who the worst person is. But what they wind up doing, led by Dick, who is the Minion who wants to follow the biggest villain, is Dort is not the biggest villain. It's ironic that the group of Minions who've been following all these other people, we see a Cyclops, we see a Warlock, we obviously know they go to see Gru, there's a beheading of a queen, that they meet a alien robot who is not a big boss, but someone who is in fact actually trying to learn about humanity and doesn't actually wind up taking over. As we see later, he and his army of Minions are the reason they defeat Irene. I'm out of stuff to talk about with this. Sora, do you have anything else you want to talk about for the movie?
So when Irene sucks up the whole entire town, they're being nice to be bad. They come out nice, and then they come back in bad. And then at the end of the movie, well, near the end, they turn Irene and, well, Irene goes into ash, and then they flip the rest of the monsters back into the wherever.
Yeah, it was a good time. I know Sawyer thoroughly enjoyed it. Thanks for joining me for spoilers, buddy. And now we're going to jump into my thoughts on the first three episodes of X-Men 97. I have actually seen the first four, but I'm only going to give my spoiler-filled thoughts on the first three episodes of X-Men 97 Season 2.
Since they went missing, there have been ripples in the time stream. I've been able to track the deviations back to two different points in time. Ancient Egypt, 3000 BCE, and the 40th century. We're looking at two of the darkest ages for humanity, and they both have one thing in common. Apocalypse.
I gave my thoughts on the first season of X-Men 97 when it came out, and I really enjoyed it. I did not think that it was the greatest thing Marvel has ever done, but in terms of reinvigorating the X-Men franchise, which, let's be honest, has totally been up and down through the Fox era, definitely a swing up from Deadpool and Wolverine, which of course was the 100th episode of the podcast. But one of my major criticisms, and unfortunately this still holds true for X-Men 97 Season 2, is the animation. Now, this is not exclusively an X-Men 97 problem. Invincible is really bad for this. Even in other series I really love, Batman Caped Crusader tends to do this too. You can see when they are doing their best to limit the amount of animation that the show has. And the only reason I bring this up is because there are other shows that I watch that I thoroughly enjoy that seem to stretch whatever their budget may be better. Mighty Nein and Vox Machina have done this significantly more effectively, and I do get completely thrown out of the show and the experience when it is simply just a PNG and a mouth is moving, or it is a PNG that would just be animated on a curve or keyframed up and down. Noticing these restraints prevent me from truly falling in love with this show. On to the actual story, I enjoyed the recap because, as is the case with so much streaming content now, there's large gaps, and hopefully this becomes more yearly, similar to some other shows. But again, if there's a longer wait, I would rather wait for better quality. I have been programmed all the way back to the Sherlock days of waiting between shows. It's okay if you can do that. If you can be the Pit, be the Pit. But on to X-Men 97 Season 2. Apocalypse is clearly the threat of this season, and what's really great for the first three episodes is really getting to understand who Apocalypse is if you are a new viewer to this show, if you are not an older millennial who grew up with the original animated series, setting the stakes for the relationship between Jean and Scott and Nathan are really important, specifically because of when he was introduced in the original season one of 97. Of course, Cable was a character they were aware of, but giving us Nathan's birth, having to have him sent off, and then seeing him as a younger adult, seeing Jean and Scott really hold it together and doing their best to be mentors to Nathan, but not revealing who they are. And the first episode is one of the great things of this show because of the way that they are able to really explore those relationships in a condensed set of time. But it is an episode that I really would have preferred being stretched out over maybe two episodes. Something that the original series did that I did really enjoy was they understood the meat of the episodes can use, or if it was an adaptation of a comic book, be stretched out over two episodes. That's only 44 minutes. Can you write a really great hour of television, in quotes, hour, and split it up? The first episode is like a shotgun of X-Men stuff. Getting to see Apocalypse, setting the stage for where all the characters are in the future, and what are the circumstances of where they are. Wolverine, of course, is dealing with his lack of metal claws now, as Magneto had pulled all the metal out, and what is that going to be for Wolverine slash Logan in this season? I'm very, very curious to seeing how they fix that problem. One of the best parts of this series, which is ironic given what all the movies did, is Wolverine is part of the ensemble. He's not the main character. But Scott and Jean are, I would say, the focus of this first episode, and getting to see their relationship with Nathan be the focus until ultimately we have the battle, and I have in my notes, cue the theme song. Getting to see Forge return to Storm, how they use their powers, fighting the, I think it's like 41 AD or 40 AD characters, and then pivoting to the 90s, which is really smart choice just in setting up this overall season. We get an episode of the future. We get an episode of the present in 1997 with X-Factor and X-Force. And I would just love to know what the viewers were thinking when we saw a custom intro that was X-Force instead of X-Men. I absolutely lost my mind when that happened. And that level of understanding the iconography of that opening theme song is so important to know. But we get to understand what's happened to the modern era since the fight with Magneto at the end of the first season, which is really important. As much as you want your main characters to return to the time they're from, things are still happening. We are running on parallel timelines as opposed to linear, where things sort of just stand still. We need to see what has happened, what has changed. X-Factor is an interesting group of characters. We get to see so many fun people within X-Force, getting to see Cable work with Jubilee and Sunspot and Psylocke. They're just awesome. And fighting against characters like Multi-Men is just, it's wild, because those are characters that are going to be a part of this grand tapestry that is the X-Men universe. But then also giving us a character like Polaris, who clearly has mixed relationships with how she has invested her time. The conversations between her and Jubilee about her dad, and then the fight that ensues, her being responsible for what they do. Not to mention, what 97 has managed to do so far is also legitimizing characters that might not necessarily be movie fans' biggest focus. Jubilee, of course, was one of the main ensemble characters in the original show, but never really got any focus at all in the films. She's sort of in one for a cameo, and then was in, what was it called, Apocalypse for a chunk. But that character didn't really get to get fleshed out in any interesting way, and I like how we've seen how Jubilee has changed during her time with Cable and X-Force, but still maintaining the morals of Xavier's School for the Gifted. And I like to see the arguments of what their method of operations and what they're willing to do for the quote-unquote greater good. I like that a lot in episode 2. Episode 3, as I said, gives us the other portion in time, the 3000 BC. We get to see En-Sabanur, who is, of course, proto-Apocalypse, and Magneto and Apocalypse going back and forth on what it means to be a mutant to the first mutant, a guy who has fought for mutant rights in maybe not the ways that Charles would have loved. And on obviously, Charles is there as well. And getting to see the journey of Apocalypse becoming Apocalypse is so rewarding. This is maybe the episode where you really would notice when they are being as frugal as possible with the animation budget. But these characters are doing something much different than what we have dealt with in the 40 AD era, where they're trying their best to hide who they are from En-Sabanur, and ultimately creating a conflict resulting in Apocalypse becoming an Apocalypse. It is that destiny was always going to happen. They are responsible. It's the bootstrap paradox. They are responsible for Apocalypse. And because of that, we get what we love, which is an X-Men 97 season 2 episode ending on "to be continued." Now, I do know what is in this episode, and I am not going to say anything about it, but overall, 3 episodes into X-Men 97, I do thoroughly enjoy this show. In terms of revitalizations of properties that I've grown up with, this was the right one to do. It's ironic that Batman Caped Crusader came out of not wanting to do Batman the Animated Series again. X-Men as a franchise has always had something to say and has reflected modern society, and bringing it back now, allowing characters like Morph to have even more to do within the series, and having that character be so important and be representative of such a underprivileged community, X-Men 97 is fantastic. In terms of bringing X-Men to the forefront, it's doing that, and I'm really excited to seeing where this show goes. Apocalypse as the main threat of this season. We know we're going to get a third season. Is there the likelihood of maybe revitalizing the other 90s Marvel TV animated series? I don't know. It would be cool. We, of course, got a Peter Parker, Mary Jane, Spider-Man, and Daredevil cameo in season 1. Maybe they want to revitalize that animated universe. It would be really cool because clearly people are invested in this. But I dug the first 3 episodes. They're more X-Men 97, and mostly that's a good thing for me. Jermaine, this segment of the podcast was dedicated to you. Thanks for the long-time listening love, buddy. Now let's get on to the movie news and TV news of the week.
Tonight at 11.
Doom! We're sitting on top of the story of the century here.
But that's not all, folks. Here's the real blockbuster. Brace yourselves. You might want to sit out.
And I need all of you to stop what you're doing and listen.
The first piece of news I want to touch on is fascinating given franchises trying to be revitalized. I obviously reviewed Masters of the Universe, and on to a franchise that has really struggled, I think, to iron out exactly what its status is in pop culture. And that is, Danny McBride confirmed on Happy Sad Confused that he has written a G.I. Joe movie, and it is set in a Cobra-run town. The G.I. Joe franchise is incredibly interesting. It tried a Transformers-esque live-action adaptation with G.I. Joe Rise of Cobra. It then did get a sort of soft reboot sequel with G.I. Joe Retaliation. And then a new continuity was started with Snake Eyes Origin, which, frustratingly, gave me Andrew Koji as Storm Shadow. Now, I am not a diehard G.I. Joe fan. It is one of those 80s franchises that I wasn't ever really invested in. There was casting in the first iteration of the live-action films that I was very much interested in. And it was in that era, yeah, when that movie totally worked for me because it was a giant toy commercial. And that is similar to what I've thought of Masters of the Universe. I find it hilarious that this brand has attempted multiple live-action franchises. Snake Eyes Origins ended with the possibility of Snake Eyes finally joining the G.I. Joes. And then, of course, I would say infamously, Transformers Rise of the Beasts confirmed that in that version of the continuity, the G.I. Joe existed. Now, we just saw sort of a green screen open warehouse and weren't really told if it was going to be a continuation. And that's really my biggest question. Is this going to be a continuation from that? Or are we starting from scratch again? I know Danny says in that interview he was interested in doing some sort of side characters. And Hasbro said, we're trying to bring this back. We really need it to be, you know, the main guys. And so Duke will be involved. Are we going to get our third iteration of Snake Eyes? Which is, in my opinion, the most iconic. Him and Storm Shadow, if you don't know G.I. Joe, you know those two characters. The black-suited ninja and the white-suited ninja, they're absolutely incredible. And then Cobra and Duke. But these are characters vaguely that I know throughout the live-action films. This is a world that you could make really cool. I think what has struggled with G.I. Joe is when the original Rise of Cobra came out, it was done in an era when people started caring about scripts, and some of the changes that they made specifically to a character like Cobra didn't necessarily go over well. I like some of Steven Sommers' films. I have a soft spot for Van Helsing, and of course really dug his two Mummy movies. So are we going to do something in that tone? Or the realism and grittiness that we got from G.I. Joe Retaliation should have worked, and it is a sequel. It has some of the coolest, again, Storm Shadow and Snake Eyes stuff, and then Snake Eyes, just it didn't work. There's so many reasons for that movie that just, it fell apart, and it was really frustrating. If you look at who's actually in that, there's a lot of people that it should have helped explode. Henry Golding was in that, of course. Andrew Koji was in that, and I'm forgetting the name of the other actor because it's been a while. It's been 5 years. Samara Weaving was in it. So many elements of this should have led to a continuation, and they never did. Is Anthony Ramos going to be in this? Because he was told about G.I. Joe. I'll be there. I commend any time they want to bring back these 80s franchises. They are big toy commercials, and those aren't necessarily bad things. The Lego Movie is a giant toy commercial. It's probably the best one, and it's one of my favorite films of all time. Barbie is another great example. It sold lots of toys. My daughter has a Ken and a Barbie from the Barbie movie. But let me know what you're thinking about another attempt at G.I. Joe. Yes or no, are you going to see it? Next piece of news is Fast 11 is finally filming. This is a franchise that I absolutely adore. If you, I mean, it's the only similarity that I have with Christopher Nolan, the long-running franchise. But what has hurt this franchise more than anything is they've not found a suitable substitute for Brian. Vin Diesel as Dominic Toretto, yes, was of course the main character, but similar to another franchise that sort of is all right, I mean, has a great first film and then kind of just sort of peters out by there, is Pirates of the Caribbean, which is Jack Sparrow, as much as he was the supporting character and one of the leads, the story's not really about him. Brian O'Connor was the main character for at least the first two Fast and Furious films, and then four onward, we got more into more of an ensemble. Of course, the real world tragedy affected 7, but 8 and 9 and 10 of making Dominic Toretto this car Jesus, to me, has not really worked narratively. There has been too much of Vin Diesel's control over the creativeness of this. The best thing that they're doing, which it seems like it's finally actually going to happen, is bringing back Hobbs. Because the back and forth of Luke Hobbs and Dominic Toretto have been incredibly important. I actually quite enjoyed 9 or 10 more than I did 9, because Jason Momoa understood what was required of him to be a compelling villain within this franchise. Quite literally being, and everyone has said this and I wholeheartedly agree, the Fast and Furious Joker. That's awesome and it works, and you need these characters to be in this elevated world. This should be the end game of this franchise, but in a way where it actually ends. The last film made money, but it was not the smash success that they were looking for. I think they were probably expecting it to be somewhere in the billions. So Fast Forever is being directed by Louis Leterrier, who came into Fast X having not originally been planned to be making it. We have Michael Leslie writing it, which I believe this is the first time he's written any of these movies. I'll be very curious if the characters that we were told were going to be not killed off, which is most Tej, Roman, Cypher, all these other characters that have sort of just been moved to the side. Of course, we know that Gal Gadot is also now alive. Han, as well as Ramsey. Are we going to get this big ensemble? Because I don't think it will work with just Dominic Toretto as the lead. You need somehow, and the irony is Fast X really did lean into the success of Fast 5. You need this to actually be a true ensemble. Whatever might be happening behind the scenes, everyone needs to feel like they are actually in scenes together for this movie to work. I love Fast and Furious, specifically 4, 5, 6, and 7. I'm doing the meme, everybody. I know it's 2026. We're done doing that, right? I hope. It needs to work. I want this franchise to end as successfully as it is possible. And with a great villain, with Hobbs truly being back, that might be the real touchstone for making this work as an ensemble, is having somebody who's willing to participate in screens with Dwayne The Rock Johnson, because those characters are fantastic together. And I hope we get the most screen time with them together that we've ever had, which the last one probably would have been Fast and Furious 6 at this point. And speaking of Dwayne The Rock Johnson, he has confirmed that Moana 3 is in development, which I find incredibly interesting. Of course, he's doing... I've said interesting too many times. Please, nobody count how many times I've said it in this episode. It's very hot, and I am slowly melting in my office. Moana 2, and I'm sure I brought this up in my Moana 2 review, was originally a season of television. And oh boy, can you tell. I love Moana. I don't believe I've done... I should check my tier list lists. I don't believe I've done a CGI Disney tier list. If I haven't, I should definitely do one around the time. I don't think I have. For when Moana comes out, of course, I've done a live action remake list. But in terms of the CGI Disney era, Moana is absolutely one of the best, which is what made Moana 2 so frustrating, because it was a lob to make a really incredible sequel that Disney has done more than you think. Of course, I grew up in the era of the VHS and DVD sequels, but who is going to be writing this if it's the directors from the original film? And one of the major factors is, and I don't know if you're going to be able to get him, Lin-Manuel Miranda. Even though he worked on the Moana project later than he did the development of Encanto, Moana has incredible music. Yes, a lot of people talk about You're Welcome and How Far I'll Go. Those songs are amazing. You could maybe write even better ones if given the chance, and that would be incredible for a third film to have the defining songs of the franchise. Are we going to get Moana 3 before Frozen 3? I don't know. I'm very curious. We did get Moana 2, I think, quicker than it took for the Frozens. I'm not going to look that up right now, because Quite frankly, it doesn't actually matter, but I will see Moana 3 as long as it's designed to be a movie and is a movie. Please don't drop this on streaming. Moana's visuals are absolutely S-tier, and that's what this character deserves to have. Her world is so interesting, and I want to care more about the supporting characters. Is her sister like she was, or maybe she's, I mean, we've seen her as a young toddler, but people change. What is their dynamic like? That's something that could easily be the main focus of a Moana 3. What about her parents? Do they finally pass away? I know it's a Disney trope, but she lost a grandma. What's going to happen when Moana actually has to be the chief for her people? That's something that I would love to see, and I want nothing but success for Moana 3. Heat 2, I mean, it's hot. It's an island. I guess that's the segue here. Has been long rumored to be being made, but we finally have some cast members that have been confirmed. I do think it's hilarious given the cast of this movie and how old some of the actors are given it being made. But Leonardo DiCaprio, Christian Bale are in it, and then in talks are Stephen Graham and Adam Driver. Now, just on male leads, this is absolutely incredible. I'm going to be reviewing The Odyssey later this year. And people might be mad at me for this, but I do think this is an incredible amalgamation of talent in the 21st century. You get people who came up through the 90s with Leo and Christian Bale, and then people who blew up within the last 15 years with Stephen Graham, of course, from Adolescence, and Adam Driver. You know who Adam Driver is. That's wild. I think Michael Mann is capable of making an incredible movie. He made an incredible movie with Heat. I didn't love Black Hat. I did quite like Ferrari. So I have nothing but high hopes for what this could be. I think it was really smart to release this as a novel before making it into a film, allowing whatever kinks might have been in the novel to be ironed out when you make it into a sequel / prequel. This is going for that sort of Godfather Part 2 element, and I think that's brilliant. And another thing that is great about what they're doing is they're not going to do de-aging. Please don't do that. I hate it. It didn't work for The Irishman, and it very rarely works, specifically if you're going to be telling a story that's taking place over such a distinct level of or amount of time. You need great actors. Elle may not be exploding on Prime maybe the way that they hoped, but if you can find the right actor to play somebody younger, just do that. Audiences have been accepting it for decades, and we will accept it as long as you cast the right people for those roles. De-aging is expensive, and more often than not, it looks absolutely terrible. Heat is obviously an incredibly influential film. I mean, I was just talking about The Odyssey. It very much influenced The Dark Knight, so I will be sitting for this day one. Even though the book does exist, I am not going to read it, similar to Project Hail Mary. I love to just see the movie, and then if I want an extended version of that, I have the opportunity to read the book, but let's be honest, I totally don't have time for that, because I'm in the midst of Dungeon Crawler Carl, like most people right now. I'm about 2/3 the way through The Eye of Bedlam Bride. That's where I am. No spoilers for that. I don't believe this was a truncated news section. I thought this was fairly long, but those are all the major movie news things that I wanted to talk about. There's been some other stuff, maybe with some more corroborating reports I'll respond to later on in this month, but that's it for news. And now let's respond to question of the week answers and listener email.
Can I ask you a question?
Just one?
There's something I really need to ask you.
I ask the questions, you answer the questions.
Why do you ask questions to which you already know the answers?
Did that count as a question?
Yes.
Damn it.
Last week's question of the week was, who is your favorite movie/TV minion or henchman? Jermaine Jones writes in, question of the week, for my favorite movie henchman, I have a tie between Hakim, aka the Fifth Floor Guardian from Game of Death, or Ren Ishii, silly Caucasian girl likes to play with samurai swords. All right. Scotty Cameron writes in, Supergirl was okay. Millie Alcock is the best live-action Supergirl. I've seen two films this year, and between Masters of the Universe and Supergirl, I think I liked Masters of the Universe more. I still enjoyed Supergirl. Question of the week response. My favorite henchman/henchman It might have to be Rhino and Muggsy because they complete the Scarface gang to help make Scarface and Ventriloquist a threat for Batman. I'll give Otis from Superman a shout out since he came from the Donner films, but made it to the cartoons and the comics. Oh, I love all the DC stuff in there. That's awesome, Scotty, and I don't expect any different from you. Legacy Odinson also gave his thoughts on Supergirl. I didn't think it was a perfect movie. Some of the editing, I think, was the biggest gripe. I also don't know if I found the case for Lobo included because of how he was handled, and it could have been better. That said, I had a good time, and I very much look forward to seeing Supergirl in the future. Question of the week response. My favorite minion is Minion of Megamind fame, but only the first Megamind. I do not acknowledge any other Megamind content. I love Megamind, and I don't know how much the world would change, but would it be better if Megamind was the franchise that continued instead of Despicable Me? I don't know. I love Megamind, though. And then Dylan Pollock writes in, I don't know if he's my favorite, but the first guy that comes to mind is Igor. I think of Marty Feldman in Young Frankenstein, but in general, he's just the best movie henchman. I love that one. And then Brian Manili of Jump on the Batwagon wrote in on YouTube, easy answer, Rolled from Letterkenny. Now, if you are not a Letterkenny fan, you are missing out on one of the greatest Canadian comedies of all time. Because you have to watch all of Letterkenny, and then you'll watch all of Shoresy. But Rold and Stewart's relationship is just absolutely incredible, and it brings me such joy, the back and forth between those people and how they grow throughout the entire run of the series. Those are some fantastic answers, and I really did like the variety. A reminder, if you don't think you have an interesting answer for Question of the Week, you can ask me one on social media. Just make sure to include the hashtag QOTW so I don't miss it, because if it's just a random thing, it may not pop up or get sort of lost in the ether that is social media. Now on to this week's Question of the Week. Next week, I will be reviewing the live-action Moana remake. I know I can hear people groaning in their headphones now, but because of that, and I don't believe I've asked this yet, Scotty, you're really great for letting me know. I did look, but I didn't see it. What is a live-action Disney film that you would like to see animated? Maybe it was restricted by the time it was made, or the budget, or just the visuals are muddy, and don't make it a movie that was a cartoon. I want something that was purely a live-action Disney film that you think would be better as an animated film. To answer the question, you can comment below on YouTube and Spotify. You can email the podcast, filmrealistpod@gmail.com, or, as I said already, you can at Film Realist on any of the social medias. All of the links are on the bio site for the podcast, but I'm on Twitter, Instagram, Threads, Blue Sky, TikTok, YouTube, all those things. I check them all. If you are watching this on YouTube, please subscribe and like the video. I switched it up there on you. It helps the podcast get into more people's algorithms and shares this reviews of a nobody that might be hopefully for somebody that they just don't know it yet. If you're not following the podcast on your preferred podcast platform, make sure to do that. Give it 5 stars. It just helps the podcast move up the ranks, which is incredible. Very recently, I was on the DC Studios talking about Supergirl. And if you would love to see some of my written work, make sure to check that out on the Multiverse of Color. I've also added a little widget for the bio site of Film Realist if you want to check out some of my major reviews on the site. Thank you so much for listening to this podcast. My name is Kyle Naranya, and I will see you next time.